Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
Recognition of Guaido.
Unelected gobshite.
Is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and so I would reprimand you over that.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back. This is I Foresee Trouble with Daly and Wallace, none other than Mick and Claire here in the studio.
We're very troubled today.
Yeah, a lot of trouble this week. No, today we're going to talk a bit about Poland, which is our country of the week on our tour around the member states of the European Union. And then we'll talk a bit about what's been happening this week in the plenary, a few interesting resolutions going through, and we'll give an update on vaccines. So maybe we'll start with the vaccines. Mick, you can tell us through. Talk us through what's the latest there.
Well, there was a very important meeting yesterday in Geneva. The World Trade Organization were meeting, and obviously the big issue at the moment is vaccines. And you had 80 developing countries who have gone together and have looked for the rules on the WTO's trade-related aspects of intellectual property agreement. It's called TRIPS. And what it is it's really enshrines the right to for pharmaceutical companies to have a patent over what they produce. And in the interest of public health worldwide, the developing countries are coming together to plead that that the rules would be waived in the interest of health, because people are dying in the developing countries. They could produce the vaccine themselves if the patent was lifted, if they got permission, if they were given the technology. This is something that they actually have the capacity to do it, but they need the cooperation of the developing world. But the likes of the US, UK, Switzerland, and many other European countries are blocking it, which is an absolute total disgrace. They are literally condemning people to die. And what's more, we will be slower to get rid of COVID if we don't help the countries who can't afford the vaccines, can't get access to them. And if you think that's bad, a story has broken as well this week about the behaviour of Pfizer in dealing with developing countries. And in particular, the story broke about they're actually supplying vaccines to 9 Latin American countries. And it's turned out that what they have demanded from these countries beggars belief. They have made sure that in the case of any problems with the vaccines, that the state in each case will pay and that Pfizer won't. They have put pressure on some countries to put up military bases and embassies as collateral against any potential problems down the line. And Pfizer and others in the big pharmas have countries over the barrel. But some countries, like, for example, Brazil and Argentina, refused to take the vaccine from Pfizer because the conditions were so draconian and it was going to be so costly for them. And they were afraid that there might be problems later on. And sovereign assets of states were being demanded by Pfizer to be put up against potential problems in the future. I mean, how in God's name the European Union would ever deal with these buckos again? I mean, we've had no choice, only deal with them this time because we don't have the capacity to make the medicine ourselves. But we should not allow this to happen again, and we should start making our own and become independent of them. Let them make what they want. I'm not advocating that you stop the private sector from working. Let them do what they want, but we shouldn't allow ourselves to be dependent on them again.
Yeah, well, the gas thing is when we say the private sector, it's as if they take the risks, and that's always been the justification for saying, oh, we need these, they're more competitive, they're the ones out on the front line. But the reality is that the governments of Europe and actually the American governments pumped in hundreds of millions into Pfizer and Pfizer BioNTech, the German equivalent, in order to assist them develop these vaccines. And then when they get them, they won't share them. They're just manipulating them in order to line the pockets of their shareholders, undermining everybody's public health. And it's the disgusting face of capitalism. And, you know, the sad fact is that the World Trade Organization rules allow for these intellectual property rights to be lifted precisely in cases of pandemic. And if they can't even do it at this level, well, then, you know, what does it say? And I mean, it also says that the contract's been undertaken by the likes of Pfizer. Sure, European governments and the EU have agreed up to that as well. It's like waiving liability that the Pfizer, if they're deemed guilty of negligence and so on, well, sure, it's probably our governments who are going to pay that as well.
And I mean, people should understand that the big concern for the likes of Pfizer and the other big pharma is that they're looking for indemnity against civil claims filed by citizens who suffer serious adverse events after being vaccinated. So, in other words, you know, as Claire said, they certainly don't want to carry the can, and they're making sure that the state does. And because they have the state over the barrel now, states are agreeing to it, unfortunately.
There's a real big sort of rush at home as well, though, isn't there? Like this idea of that there's a crisis in vaccinations and this run and grab them, like, and we're getting emails from people saying, what are you doing to get us vaccines here in Ireland? Like, you know, we're lagging behind, they're not being delivered or whatever. But we can't really see the debate in that context. I mean, this is a world problem, and it has to be addressed collectively, really. It's not a case of us running, bagging a few million doses, running away with it, and then we'll be all right, Jack, because we won't unless it's dealt with by everybody, you know.
And the European Union is a big defender of the intellectual property rights. We had Ursula von der Leyen here not so long ago, very clearly saying that she doesn't have any intention to even talk about lifting these patents. But what's the big justification there? Like, of course, like you were saying there, Claire, about they talk about the private sector taking the risk. We need to protect their innovation, whatever. But there's clearly doesn't stand. It doesn't hold water if we're talking about the WTO and the need in a pandemic and all this. So what's the actual justification? What else are they saying there to maintain the patents?
They're actually not even putting up an argument. Mm-hmm. They're more or less saying, well,
it's not necessary. Everything
will be grand. They just don't want to, because they see it as costing them money.
Well, it's a principle. It's undermining the base of capitalism, really. That's what they're at. I mean, they don't give a justification at all. They basically say there's no need for it because we have this COVAX scheme, which is supposedly the benevolent companies, the likes of Pfizer and the European, given a token few million vaccines there as if that will deal with it. It's the sort of general argument that we have over charity or whatever. You throw a few crumbs and think that's okay to allow you to keep the bakery and make all the cakes for yourself. And that's really what they're doing with the vaccines as well.
That's a good analogy. Let's move on and talk a bit about a vote that happened this week. It was quite important. Three votes that were secret ballot was because there was three Catalans who are MEPs in the European Parliament. And it was a vote on waiving their immunity because of their involvement in the Catalan elections. That's Carles Puigdemont, who we all know. There's Clara Ponsati as well, and Antoni Comín. Claire, you've been involved in this as well in the European Parliament. You know them pretty well as too.
Well, so, we both have, and we were both in prison in on a visit in Barcelona not just about a year ago, to their colleagues who have been given sentences of up to 13 years in some instances for sedition, for the same thing, for their role as elected parliamentarians in Catalonia in organising a referendum. And Basically, you know, everybody knows, or most people do, that there's been attempts made previously by the Spanish authorities to extradite them back to Spain to answer charges of sedition. The Belgian and the Greek and German governments have refused on those grounds that they wouldn't get a fair trial and all the rest of it. And when they were elected to the European Parliament, because you have immunity from prosecution, unless the Parliament decides to vote that away from you, their kind of hands were tied. So now by this vote, which I think only about 220 or something.
I have the numbers here. It's 400 in favour, 248 against, and 45 abstentions.
So basically what it does is give a kind of a green light to the Spanish authorities to go after them again. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll succeed again, but it does mean increased repression. And we've seen that already back at home in Spain, with some judiciary taking decisions on other people who are back in Spain and turning the screws on them. But the sick irony of it is that we have an MEP here who is a member of the Golden Dawn group, the fascist group in Greece, which have been outlawed because of their criminality, where they've murdered people. And this man is wanted for investigation, and the parliament upheld his immunity. And here we have elected Catalan officials whose only crime was to organise a referendum. And let's remember that they are in lawfully in government in Catalonia at the moment, their colleagues. They've recently won a majority. They won a majority in the elections.
Yeah.
And they're being silenced like this. It'll make you absolutely sick.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it takes away the European Union's right to throw stones at anybody else talking about democracy and freedom. If we don't apply it at home in our own member states, then how in God's name can we say to somebody else, you don't have democracy, you don't have freedom, when we don't even have it ourselves here?
Yeah, and it's another example of the repressive Spanish state getting what it wants, and its influence in bodies like here, which we've been struck by since we got here. It's absolutely incredible. Yeah. But it continues,
sadly. And people might be interested in the fact that it was a secret ballot. It doesn't happen that often in the European Parliament, but it does happen in these votes that are about waiving immunity. So that also has an impact as well on the vote. There's, of course, a huge amount of pressure as well from Spain and from other places to vote a certain way. But actually, the vote wasn't that bad. Like, 248 people in the European Parliament is actually more than I would have expected, that said that we shouldn't be waiving this immunity. So
it was shocking.
No, but in terms of numbers of what I would have dissected myself in the parliament.
Okay,
you know?
But you're saying out of 705 members, right?
Yeah.
Only 248 wanted to protect democracy in Spain.
Yeah, that doesn't, that's a good number.
And they've only 248 out of over 700 want to protect democracy in Spain. And even though it's a secret vote, right? You can start doing your sums pretty easily, right?
You can figure out.
And who are the 400 that voted to have the matter lifted? Mm. Well, you can be fairly well assured that the right wing parties,
including the S&Ds.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, S&Ds absolutely, because they're full of Spaniards. Well, I could ask the Fine Gaelers and the Fianna Fáilers what way they voted, but between ourselves now, I have a fair idea what way they did.
I'd say
and
they'd democracy, probably say
democracy,
it.
I think, would be something that's...
It's how narrow-minded of them.
I mean, just terrible, John.
But yeah,
terrible.
Anyway, yeah. So
just short-sighted, because it's not really about... They were basically putting their own opinions on the situation in Spain ahead of the principle of, you know, why the immunity is there in the first place. Like, what
and
a
thankfully
joke.
Belgium is standing up against this extradition.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But anyway, Puig Demont called it a sad day for European democracy. And that's their waiver, their immunity lifted. Doesn't mean that they're being sent away straight away to Spain or anything, but it's just one step in the story there. Maybe we'll talk a bit about some of the other stuff happening in the plenary now. There was a big resolution on Syria, which was probably the big item of the week. It's 10 years since the start of the conflict there. Mick, you were involved in that.
Yeah.
The resolution, that is.
Yeah, well, myself and Claire have been to Syria twice, and we're very interested in the country. And it is absolutely shocking what's going on. I was in the plenary the night when the High Representative Joseph Borrell was speaking on it. And one of the things he said was that... He says the sanctions will not be lifted until we get change. And when he means change, he means regime change. And he says peace is not won by crushing a people. Well, he's actually right. Peace is not won by crushing a people. But what he forgot to add was that in actual fact, the EU has supported the US, Israel and the Gulf states who have sought regime change in Syria. And there are sanctions in place now. They're called the Caesar sanctions, right? And they're actually described as being medieval in their nature. They are so bad. We are literally persecuting the people of Syria. And the EU is supporting this 100% because they see this as a way of getting regime change. For the last 10 years, this war has gone on. It started out at the time of the Arab Spring. There was a protest against Assad because, Assad represents a dictatorship. But there's a dictatorship in most of those countries in that region. And in actual fact, there's only been democracy in Syria in 7 of the last 500 years. So it's not like as if the people weren't used to it. But what happened then was that outside forces like the US and European countries, Israel and the Gulf states, started to arm Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra and any terrorist that would carry a gun to go in and destabilise Syria. But this is not the story being told. You won't hear this on RTE. What you'll hear is you'll hear the RTE quoting the White Helmets and the Syrian Observatory as if they were neutral media outlets. When in actual fact, the Syrian Observatory are paid for by the British government. The White Helmets were designed by the American government to do a job for them to help the regime change come about. And the lies and the propaganda that we've got about Syria is unprecedented in my lifetime. I have never seen debate of it. It is so bad. And it's just shocking that RTE and unfortunately most of the mainstream print media at home have bought into this narrative, which is a bag of lies.
Well, it's unbelievable, I always find. I mean, like, it's obviously very, very true that loads of Syrians don't like Bashar al-Assad. Loads of people don't like Micheál Martin, but that's not an excuse for, you know, the assembled world armies to come in and invade Ireland to rescue us, like, you know. But that's actually the analogy of what happened in Syria. And unlike the Gulf states and that, Syrians actually do have elections and that, and a lot of electoral changes were brought in the country, and it's up to them to try and sort that out for themselves. But I mean, these Caesar sanctions, which were brought in at the last end of the Trump administration, are just to crucify any efforts at reconstructing the country, because, you know, in a large part the country was retaken by the Syrian government with the help of Russia and Iran. But to rebuild it, they need the sanctions lifted. They need the ability to try and do business as normal. And there are actually loads of people who are refugees around the world and in other parts of Syria who'd love to return to their own country, but they need the basis for that. And I mean, we met the Syrian ambassador for lunch yesterday, along with some colleagues, and he was making the point about the illegality of the sanctions, the hypocrisy.
And on that, like, this resolution, it's being voted actually today, so we'll see the results by the end of the day. It actually supports the current sanctions and proposes to increase them. Now, the two of you have an amendment in. So that's the resolution that's been negotiated between all the groups. It's going to the vote. It's probably going to stay that way after the vote. But you have an amendment in, the two of you, that's about the illegality of these sanctions. The unilateral course of measures from the US and the EU, which are not done through the Security Council. So the point you're making is about the illegality of them. Do you think that message will resonate? Well, I mean, or do you think anyone will pick up on that?
Well, because, I tell you what, I mean, it doesn't resonate with the politicians in Europe. It doesn't resonate with the 27 member state governments, but it will resonate with the people. This is a breach of international law. Israel bombs Syria whenever it feels like it, and nobody condemns them for it in the European Union. Nobody. It is a disgrace. And the Americans are illegally occupying Syria. The Americans are illegally stealing oil from Syria. Turkey is illegally occupying Syria. Israel is illegally occupying the Golan Heights in Syria. And Irish troops are used to protect the Israeli position there. And, I mean, Russia and Iran came into the war. They were invited by a sovereign state of Syria to come in and defend them against the jihadists who were being supported by the Western governments. And so they are not illegally in the country because the state invited them in. Turkey, Israel, the US, and sadly all with European support are breaking international law. As you said, Damien, it doesn't have a UN resolution. And any sanctions that are implemented without a UN resolution are illegal against the UN Charter, against international law. And it's an awful pity that we don't have a media that will shout that from the rooftops to the people of Europe to see, can we actually help protect the people from Syria from suffering? And another issue, there's over 3 million refugees from Syria in Turkey. The European Union doesn't want them to come to Europe, and it doesn't want them to go back to Syria, even though loads of them want to go back, because they see it as bolstering the Syrian state. So they don't want them to go to Syria, they don't want them to go to Europe, they don't want them to go anywhere. They're happy for them to be in cages in Turkey, and we're paying about $3 billion a year to Turkey to keep them in cages, to stop them from getting to Europe and stopping them from going back to Syria. This is absolute madness.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, when, and that was, I found sickening by Borrell the other night, he's going, we in the European Union have given 22 billion to Syria over the last on the Syrian issue over the last number of years, meaning they've given billions, as Mick says, to the likes of Erdogan's regime in Turkey to keep Syrian people in cages and in destabilising the area and in continuing to back the sanctions. But the sad thing is that, like Mick very clearly articulated, the illegality of the sanctions, that's not in the public minds of people. When people hear it, and they were at it in the Parliament the other night because of the media, they think, oh no, we're in there now because we're helping all these poor Syrians because of that awful Assad. And we had even deputies getting up again and repeating what has been demonstrated to be a lie, and they're still repeating it, that the Syrian government used chemical weapons against their own people in Douma. Now, there was an investigation in that by the OPCW, which said, yeah, there might be some evidence there. But you're, of course, like the weapons of mass destruction that we had in Iraq and the dodgy dossiers, the workers inside the OPCW have come out and whistleblowers and demonstrated that that report was fabricated in order to make the Syrian government look bad.
And not only that, right, but I mean, the leaks from the whistleblowers in the OPCW, because they did have an investigation, and they found that the whole thing was staged. And it was staged, they reckon, by the White Helmets, right? But in actual fact, when the claim was made that time that Assad had used chemical weapons in Douma, it was a pretext for a massive US, UK and French missile attack on Syria, right? I mean, and now the whistleblowers in mainstream media, and unfortunately in the New York Times, BBC, Bellingcat, The Guardian and our own Irish papers, they are not telling the truth about this. The whistleblowers are being put down, and it's a bit, people remember what happened to Maurice McCabe at home. I mean, whistleblowers, it's a tough game being a whistleblower. It's so hard to get support. And these whistleblowers in the OPCW now are being literally been abused for telling the truth.
And they really, you know, their case does need to be highlighted. They've done a great service, or tried to. Yeah. But imagine being, you know, penalised and ostracised and your whole future and life in danger just because you bore truthful testimony and you spoke about what you saw and what happened, which goes against the official narrative. You know, it is scary stuff, and yeah, we really salute them and stand by them.
Exactly. So we'll see how this resolution goes. As we said, it's 10 years after the breakout of the war. But I think it is just a bit sad in any case that there's going to be a resolution voted that doesn't even call on member states to stop their airstrikes. It doesn't even talk about any form of communication with any authorities on the ground for humanitarian assistance. And it actually talks about ramping up sanctions after they've been crippling the population as well for so long. Mick, you also had a meeting as well with Borrell during the week you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, just briefly.
Before we talk about Poland, because it's quite related, I think.
We're trying to do shorter episodes. People are telling us to do shorter episodes, but yet there's so much happening that it's so hard for us to fit everything in. On Monday evening, Borrell came before, and he came in person. It wasn't just in camera. And he's actually pretty good at turning up at the foreign affairs committees. But it was about the EU-Russian relations, right? So following the arrest and imprisonment of Navalny, of course, everyone knows at this stage that Borrell went to Russia, and it turned out he came away with a bloody nose. Lavrov made mincemeat of him. But both myself and Claire have argued that Borrell was dead right to go. Dialogue is important.
And to remind people, it's equivalent to a foreign affairs minister at EU level. So it's not like he's just some random diplomat.
That's just part of his job, is to talk to other countries. And you have to talk to everybody. Dialogue makes sense. But anyway, he went, as I got speaking time at it, and I made the point. Listen, I said, you're dead right to go. I said, but you went with a bad hand of cards. And I says, all the anti-Russian rhetoric, I said, that's going on in this place, I says, didn't help you, I says, when you went. I said, you don't have a strong rational position in your handling of Russia. I said, Navalny was arrested, and in my opinion, he shouldn't have been arrested. He shouldn't be in jail, but he went epileptic about the fact that he was arrested. And I pointed out that in 2020 alone, the Israelis killed over 30 Palestinians. They didn't arrest him and put him in jail like Navalny was arrested and put in jail. They murdered him. And was there any EU sanctions against Israel? No. Israel is still stealing Palestinian land on a daily basis. And are we even talking about sanctions against Israel? No. Well, likewise, the Americans are stealing oil in Syria. And would we consider sanctions against America? No. And I made the point that, listen, it would make sense if we start applying the same rules to everybody before we start throwing stones at Russia. It just doesn't stack up.
Well, I mean, it was gas. And I mean, we had a similar situation with the Parliament's debate on Georgia, which was kind of the same thing. And I thought it was really gas. I mean, last month we had everybody and they couldn't get us. There was no speaking time available. So many people wanted to get up and give out about Navalny being arrested for breaching his bail conditions. And, you know, Borrell was getting berated for it. So this month now we've another opposition leader whose offices were stormed for breaching his bail, and he was put in prison in Georgia, Anika Melia. And there's hardly a word about it in the Western media. Charles Michel, the president of the European Council, goes over there on a visit, invites everybody to dinner, all the sides, tell them all to calm down, sit down, dialogue is the way forward, don't be ratcheting up a gear. And all the MEPs get up and say, what a great lad Charles Michel is, isn't he great there arguing for dialogue? If I was Borrell, I'd be sitting there, this is, how did I get such a short straw? But the reality is, of course, is that both the ruling Georgian Dream party in government and the opposition, the United National Movement, are both Atlanticist. Mm. They're both pro-NATO. Yeah. They've both engaged in neoliberal shock therapy and free market reforms there. So actually the EU is kind of happy to deal with both of them. That's what's reflecting their position, which just goes to show again the utter sickening hypocrisy of these people who manipulate language around human rights and democracy to justify what they do, when actually what they're doing in Georgia is trying to keep everybody sweet because they're happy to do business with them on that vital link to the Caucasus through the Caspian Sea. Whereas in Russia, they want to ratchet it up with Russia because of, having a bogeyman to boost their military might. Mad stuff. Hypocrisy unbounded.
I think our listeners are getting used to what it's like in the European Parliament now at this stage, no matter what country it is. And this week's country, it's our focus is on Poland. We only have a quick 5 minutes for our whirlwind tour of Poland. So who wants to kick us off with some interesting insights into the Polish representation in the European Parliament? There's a lot of them, actually.
He has more friends.
We've only had little countries so far, but now we have a big one. So,
I think people forget how big Poland is. It's over 38 million people. and no, they're I think
the fifth biggest in the Parliament.
Yeah,
they're big, like, yeah.
There are 52 MEPs here, and now, like much of Eastern Europe, their MEPs tend to be of a right-wing persuasion also. They're very they're very prominent on my committees, on the Foreign Affairs and Security and Defence. There's loads of them on both of them. They would be very strongly anti-Russian. Now, aside from that, there's been a lot of coverage about rule of law in Poland, a lot of challenges to it. We have the LGBT...
exclusion zones. Yeah, all them,
I mean, they haven't been good. And I listened to a Polish MEP last night in the plenary, more or less challenging any notion of rights for LGBT. It was pretty shocking now what he was saying in this day and age.
They talk a lot about family rights and this kind of stuff. It's their way of...
I know. Yeah. They try and undermine LGBT with, we want real families with mothers and fathers and children.
Yeah.
Well, in actual fact, I haven't met anyone of an LGBT persuasion who doesn't like that either. Right? So, I mean, it really doesn't stack up. And but look, it's a huge country. I've been in it a couple of times. The food is kind of different there. I was there for the European Championships in 2012. They have good beer. I'm not me as mad about their food.
Pierogi, do you have?
They've what's their most famous dish?
The dumplings, maybe. The
dumplings, yeah. They love the dumplings. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's, of course, the Irish people now are pretty familiar with them. Mm. There's over 200,000 Poles came to Ireland. Mostly they started coming in around the year 2000.
Well, yeah, with the expansion of the EU actually as well, it's that quite correlation as well with, it was 2004 when all these 10 new countries joined the EU and free movement, then rights happened and we had this big wave of Poles especially coming
in. But there was Poles coming in before 2004 and they were, obviously I was involved in the construction industry all my life, but the Poles were the first to arrive. And they came before 2004, from my memory. And they came in small numbers first. There was about 30,000 came first, and they were perceived to be very, very good workers. And obviously they were getting well paid. So the word went home. And after 2004, they came in their droves, and over 200,000 ended up in Ireland. After the crisis, the banking crisis in 08, 09, which obviously construction took a major dip and it collapsed more or less, some of them did go home, but the majority of them stayed. And there's a very strong Polish community in Dublin still today and around different parts of Ireland. I did a podcast for a Polish MEP last week, which was really interesting. And they were very interested in the Polish community in Ireland, and he was asking me loads of questions about how the Poles are perceived and all. And he was kind of amused by the fact that I know my experience at home, there were so many East Europeans came that we probably struggled to tell the difference between some of the East Europeans in different countries. Anyway. Claire, what's your...
I'm just shocked thinking of your interview with the Polish MEP, because he actually asked Mick, do people in Ireland really eat crisp sandwiches? And Mick, who of course is a really good eater, said, I never heard of that. Absolutely
not. That's not what I said.
Well, you said that they didn't, and they do, and they love them.
Listen,
That's what you said. And Oisín was there.
You weren't there,
well,
right?
We all have to listen to the Polish podcast.
The MEP was Robert Biedron, and a really nice fella. And he started his own party called Spring in February 2019. And they've already got loads of, I think there's something like 19 members in the parliament in Poland now, which is a fantastic for a new party starting. And he's actually a huge LGBT activist. And for an LGBT activist in Poland, He told me he has 6 million followers on Facebook. That's incredible.
Oh, yeah. Has you envying any?
I mean, but social media is massive, he told me, in Poland.
Yeah.
He has over 400,000 followers on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
He says social media, he says, is the way that the Poles get their news.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, everything. Poland is a very important country, and I think it is probably our second after the Brits? Are the Polish people the second nationality in Ireland? I'm not sure, something like that. And obviously I too would know loads of Polish people from that time when they all came in, and we had loads of working with us in Aer Lingus, and some of my best friends would be among them. But my experience of them here in the parliament has been a bit different, because Mick's right that kind of, I actually find them different than the rest of the Eastern Europeans, because they're incredibly right wing. I mean, it is true that the other Eastern European countries are very anti-Russian, and but they would have people spread out across the S&Ds and Renew, whereas the Poles dominate the conservative group, which is the smallest group apart from the left.
Mm.
But there's more than half the Poles in it, yeah, of their representation, are in that, yeah, small group. They're completely dominant. 26 out of the 52 are in that second smallest group. So they're very conservative. And then they've 17 in the EPP, in the right wing, sort of Fine Gael groups. They only have a smattering of others in the S&D. They've nobody even in the Liberal Renew Party, which although it's liberal economically, it's liberal socially as well. Mm. So they don't, and they've nobody in the left. They tend to be older people.
Mm.
They're old people who've served their time. Yeah. They're kind of grouchy old people who were maybe ministers or involved. They're not vibrant, dynamic. That's why Mick's pal, and there was a young girl who was in the S&Ds who joined the Greens, who's an abortion and an LGBT activist and that as well. She's a bit done out, but that's exceptional. So they're strange for that. They're very, very conservative. But,
and still, their former Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, he was elected as President of the last European Council, for 5 years.
Yeah.
And he was fairly formidable in his position, and probably a lot stronger than the present fella, Michel. Mm. I mean, Michel is piss poor, weak. Tusk would
be. And just in case the Poles think we're insulting them, he's not Polish, he's Belgian.
Yeah.
Who?
Michel.
The way you said it, it kind of sounded like he might be Polish.
Tusk was a much more formidable player as president of the council than Michel is.
He was. And a point that we said we'd do was to talk about interesting or famous people from the countries. And actually, the Poles gave us Copernicus, the famous scientist. They gave us Frederick Chopin, the fantastic musician. And the wonderful Rosa Luxemburg as well, the socialist and revolutionary campaigner.
Marie Curie.
Cannot talk about Poland and talk about who they gave us. Lewandowski, one of the best strikers on the planet today. He is very, very good. Playing for Poland and playing for Bayern Munich. He's a seriously good player. And I remember I was at the World Cup in 1982 when the Poles had a powerful team and they were beaten 2-0 in the semi-final by Italy. I was at the match. Paolo Rossi, who actually died a few months ago, got the 2 goals. Rossi had actually been let out of prison in order to play in the tournament, which was fair play to the Italians for letting him out. He ended up being the top scorer and Italy won the World Cup in 82. But they had Banyak was one of the famous players at the time. He was a brilliant player. And they had a famous goalkeeper called Timoszewski, who Brian Clough described as a clown before England were playing Poland and the winner was going to qualify for the World Cup. And Timoszewski knocked England out of the World Cup. It wasn't actually in 82. It was in the previous one in 78. England didn't go to Argentina for the World Cup in 78 because Poland knocked them out. And Timoszewski was in goal. And everyone remembers Clough calling him a clown. And when England were playing him and the Poles beat him 1-0, they could not get the ball past this clown. He was a very good goalkeeper as well.
Yeah, I think it would be wrong to leave Poland without mentioning the fact that they are under infringement procedures for their rule of law breaches. In relation, there's been huge problems around the independence of the judiciary and interference in that regard. There's obviously the LGBT exclusion zones, which are completely illegal and a breach of fundamental rights. And then there's been rocked by huge movements with the restriction on abortion rights, which were already the most restricted in Europe.
Mm.
But they lifted the possibility for women to have abortions in cases of fatal fetal abnormalities and so on, sparking a huge huge movement. And I mean, you know, it is important that the commission took action against them for breaching fundamental rights, but they do have an argument to say, why are you always picking on us and Hungary when the likes of Spain and France and all these are breaching fundamental rights and Bulgaria and no one takes any action about it?
So. But it's true. Even like about media, I can see there's a rake of different resolutions and things specifying Poland and Hungary. Usually they're the targets, usually for good reasons as well. But I think in one way it paints a picture of Poland as a very conservative place. And like listening to what Mick was saying about that MEP and the big following there, there's actually a very progressive people. Like when you look at abortion rights as well, I think if you look at the actual statistics in the country, like people are way in favour of reproductive rights like this. So it's just that they're very conservative government.
I think, and a lot of people left, a lot of the young people left when the European Union opened up and went around, and then you had whole places where, you know, there were no young people left. It's reversed a bit and some people have come back, which is good. And actually they do have some very interesting national policies as well. So a big player here.
Yeah. They do a huge amount of work in the Environment Committee to bring down loads of ambition ruin everything. But they're hard workers in every respect there. We're just talking about Poland there, but there was this resolution about LGBT freedom zone that happened during the week. It was just voted. So the Parliament announced Europe as a LGBT freedom zone, which is a reaction to the Polish
thing. I think it was a good initiative by the Parliament, like, you know, to take that, to be a bit proactive and make a difference. And it makes a very big difference to people back in Poland, a little bit like the way the European bodies ruling on Ireland's restrictive abortion regulations had a good shot in the arm for the activists in Ireland. So it's kind of similar for the activists in Poland. So that was a welcome step for sure. And I mean, look, it is good that it took place in the week of International Women's Day. I suppose my message on that is to look at its history, and the history of the struggle around International Women's Day is very much rooted in the struggle for socialism and the struggle to change society.
Yeah, absolutely. Shinna Will. Okay, thanks everyone for listening. We need to pick a name out of the hat of the country, so you can do
Let's pick
Claire.
It. Go on. It's Austria.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh my God. Okay. Out of a frying pan into another frying pan.
Oh, God.
Austria it is.
See you next time. Auf Wiedersehen.